Hello and welcome to Dateline New Haven on WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio. I'm Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make our community tick. That was the Afro-Semitic experience with Elio Hanavi. And today it's Thursday Pundits. This is that time as the week's drawn to a close where we get the greatest minds in New Haven media to go over the headlines to see what it all means. And yes, you're surprised, but I'm going to explain why in a minute. So Marquisha Ricks and Lucy couldn't make this week, but we have, as always, Babs Rawls Ivy, the editor of the Inner City News, host of Love Babs, Love Talk, and on pretty much every board that makes anything happen in New Haven. Good morning, Babs. Thanks for coming on over an hour if you're ready. And then the reason he's the number one pundit, in my opinion, in New Haven, is because he doesn't just type comments on the New Haven Independent. He prepares thought-out, well-written, really interesting, insightful, and provocative commentary, which is what a genuine pundit does instead of a wink pundit in quotes. The Reverend Samuel Ross Lee, the pastor of Emmanuel Baptist Church, for now, but not for long, I guess, chair of the Civilian Review Board, former head of the Ethics Board, and the person I look to read first in the New Haven Independent to figure out what stories mean. Welcome to Thursday Pundits and welcome to being a pundit.
Welcome, Ross Lee.
Thank you.
Reverend.
How does it feel? Are you proud to be a pundit? Are you just happy with pastor?
Well, we'll see how the pundit thing goes.
You know, you were my suggestion, just FYI.
And just, I would argue that the Thank comments you do, and you can put your name to them. I would argue the comments you put in New Haven Independent was what we used to call op-eds.
Yeah.
Where someone who really has something to say and knows something spends a while, makes an argument with evidence and a conclusion, and has the sentences line up. And like, I really appreciate what you do there. And thank you for that. But now let's rumble and see if you're still in the game.
Let's see.
Okay. So we're going to go over the headlines and stories. And what we usually do now on pundits is we start out with quotes. And just for fun, see if you can guess who it is. Ready, folks? This had to do with the story this week. Okay. I think this one's an easy one. Why do you go through all the hassle of getting this job, of putting yourself in a position of authority?
Senator.
Yes. If your answer, as the slaughter increases, as our kids run for their lives, we do nothing. What are we doing? Why are you here if you're not going to solve a problem? I'm here to beg, to literally get down on my hands and knees and beg my colleagues.
Chris Murphy.
Find a path forward, work with us to make this less likely. U.S. Senator Chris Murphy has been the leading voice in Washington on gun control since the Sandy Hook massacre. And it's not really a competition.
So she said for the win.
No, you said senator first.
I said senator. She said for the win.
Actually, we can argue about who won. But Senator Murphy was on the floor of the Senate after the horrible massacre in Texas where 19 elementary school students, two teachers, were gunned down by an 18-year-old. He's saying, if not now, when? He's actually working with Republicans, sitting down with them and saying, can we get 10 Republicans for some kind of gun control, whether it's those red flag laws where you kind of see someone like this or someone else might be a problem and stop them. What did you folks think after the massacre about whether politicians are at issue here and whether laws are at issue?
They are. They are an issue. They are afraid, cowardly, of their constituents.
Republicans.
The Republicans are. They're afraid of being primaried because there's going to be some other nut who runs against them if they try to work for gun control, and they know that. And so they are afraid to do anything. But what I thought immediately after this particular shooting in Texas was that we haven't finished grieving the one in Buffalo.
You know, I can't keep track of them ever, so you have to be honest. Whenever these happen, you get the list of the last five. I've completely forgotten. Like, there was just the Jewish one, right?
No, I'm still in Sandy
was the
Hook.
Jewish one?
I'm still grieving Sandy Hook. So
Texas,
that's always my That's my place right there.
And I guess the reason I asked that question, and I do happen to agree with your answer, that laws matter, they can save lives. You know, they point out there was an assault rifle ban. These were assault rifles, and the number of the mass murders did go down, and then the act expired. I think laws matter a lot, you know, in terms of why people even need assault rifles or magazines that could fire so many shots at once, or whether people could so easily buy the guns like this 18-year-old. But I have to admit that with more guns than people in the country, and with this kind of crazy love of guns and this political bowing down to it, I wonder whether even a law or two is going to change it. I guess in Connecticut, we've done pretty well. We've passed the strongest gun control legislation in the country. I don't know if that reflects a culture that has less of this violence, even though we had Sandy Hook, or whether, you know, is it a chicken, the egg? How important law is, and what else is at stake? Republicans say it's mental health and culture.
Well, first of all, why is a law like that expiring? It doesn't make any sense.
I think it's the only way they could have passed it.
And why is that? You know, and this whole issue has been traced back, unfortunately, to racism. The stacking of guns and the getting of guns after
Obama's election.
No, after emancipation.
Right, right. It did happen. It did happen again after Obama was elected. There was a record increase in gun sales.
But the culture has always been there. And you know, you have peaks of, you know, when did they start noticing and taking record of the buying of guns? When did they start doing that? At what point? But this country has a history of stacking guns because white people were afraid of the freed black people. And they did all kinds of things, you know, turned slave laws into slave code into black code. The mass incarceration of black people, all kind of systems that reinvented slavery, basically. But the guns was a major part of it.
And then when the Black Panthers in the 1960s went to the state capitol in California and showed what they could legally do by brandishing rifles,
look how conservatives
passed gun control.
Oh, wow. That. Look
right,
at that.
Right.
It's that was possible. Kind
of bizarre. Well, you know, someone suggested that to stop the shooting of African-American people, all African-Americans should get life insurance. Because the insurance companies hate to pay out money. So if all of us got life insurance,
interesting.
I mean, we should just do it on the perspective that cops are killing us at high numbers. So,
yeah. But the point is that these companies will have a vested interest in trying to stop some of this, you know, shooting of black people.
You know, that's a good idea. We should start that movement.
There you go.
Any other thoughts about Chris Murphy? Do you think he's doing a good job? Do you think he's posturing? Do you think he's succeeding? Do you think he's giving it the best fight?
I don't think he's posturing. I think people who make statements who don't do anything are posturing. Obviously, we know Connecticut has done much better around this than many other states, particularly southern states. But if your words meet your actions, you're not posturing. When your words don't,
he's really trying to get something over the line here.
Right.
The red flag laws, I think when you can try to make it easier to catch someone in the system who poses a potential threat, you know, I think that's obvious. I think that's no brainer because some of the Republicans are opposing it actually passed the laws. Rick Scott passed the law.
I think that's fine, but look what Texas is doing. They're trying to sort of get rid of permit all the way so that you can just buy a gun without any background checks and without even applying for a permit. So that means Rite Aid and CVS and anybody who wants to sell a gun can sell a gun and people can walk in and buy one.
Right.
We don't want that. You know, there has to be checks and balances. I mean, we act as though we can't cure this, and we absolutely can cure this. Yeah. There's no political will to do it.
Right.
And why is that when a majority of the country supports reasonable gun control?
Because many people in the country do not vote their interests. They vote their fears. And the Republicans are good at selling fears.
They're fear mongers.
Yeah, from the Civil War. I mean, the people who actually fought the Civil War had no real interest in the maintaining slavery. The poor and working class, if you want to call it that, people who actually went there, fought and died were not the people on the plantations or on the slaves. But the people who did own the plantation and own the Africans who were held hostage on southern plantations told them that if these people are freed, they're going to come after your women and they're going to enslave you and they're going to do this. And those are the people who fought. And they've been doing that you know,
because what you don't want to have happen is freed black people and poor white people aligning themselves, you know.
Right.
I mean, history, we, I mean, that's just aristocracy history 101 right there.
Does either of you have optimism about what the news headline on the subject will be next week in terms of movement on any legislation or action?
No.
Or as a factor in the elections?
My optimism is when they actually do something. Mm-hmm. I'm tired of listening to people talk. I'm tired of reading about people saying things when they actually do something.
All right, what we're going to do is remind people to listen to Pundit Thursday on WNHHFM with Reverend Samuel Ross Lee and Babs Rawls Ivy. Quote, he believes in the people. I believe in him.
Somebody said that about Trump, I'm sure.
No, it's local. It's local.
Oh, that's local.
New Haven headlines.
Oh, Lord.
Everything else here will be New Haven.
Okay.
A little scary.
I'll give you a hint.
Okay.
She lives in West Hills.
I don't know where anyone lives.
Is this is not Honda, is it?
It is Alder Honda, Honda Smith.
Okay.
And I'll tell you why she thinks she said this. She spoke at a press conference this week when Mayor Justin Elkert named his pick for new police chief, Carl Jacobson.
Okay.
And she said, he's been working with me on kids and violence and being out in the community, and I support him. I hope the Board of Alders will, my colleagues will vote to approve Carl Jacobson as the next police chief in New Haven. I could tell you why I think it's interesting that Honda said that, but tell me if you think it's interesting.
I mean, I think he has a, as what I understand, he has a real commitment to community policing and community working with community mm-hmm. in a very personal way.
So. For me, this is about narratives and news. Mm-hmm. So we just went through a process for a year where the mayor was promoting someone to be the police chief who many in the community really did not want. It was not out in the community, had kind of a history of whether it's racism within the department or whatever. And he fought for it and fought for it. And the Board of Alders has to approve the choice of police chief. And they shot her down, which was hard to do. That doesn't usually happen. And it was overwhelming. It was almost unanimous. And the narrative was they shot her down because she's white and a lot of the Alders are black. But the narrative was not that that reflected some concern in the black community. It was that it was racist because one of them said, since she became the chief for the first time in over 30 years, all the top ranks became all white. Like it happened within minutes. Like you said, there are a lot of reasons, whatever. And there was no plan to change that, no commitment to change that.
Mm-hmm.
And people saying, and someone said, in the context of a larger discussion, when I go on the police station, I want to see someone in a high rank who looks like me. So and everyone who turned out to support the chief was white, including officers who have kind of rough reputations. I actually believed it was the revival of the beatdown posse, but that's another discussion, old story, because she got rejected. But the narrative became black alders, black leaders are insisting that the chief has to be white. Now, all that time that they were shooting down her, almost every black person who spoke up was advocating for a white police chief named Carl Jacobson, who's not like Mr. Liberal. He's not like some guy who acts black, right? But he had these really strong relationships with the community. When he was in charge of Intel, he actually sometimes sent flowers to people's houses. He broke the door down saying, you know, I'm really sorry. I want to talk to you. I had to do that. You know, and like he, and like Honda Smith is an alder who had worked with him on some of the violence in West Hills where he would keep her up to date. He shows up. He lives near there. He'd show up, you know, at night. And so, and the street outreach workers who tended to be of color were saying, he's the guy we work with. And no matter how many times that was said and known, the story continued to be, including a reporter at the press conference said, well, he's not the right color anyway. They said they want to see someone looks like me, so I guess he'll get shot down too. So what I predict you that it's going to be an overwhelming, maybe unanimous, show of support from a majority black and Latino board for this white police chief.
Well, oftentimes when people use that kind of narrative to describe our disagreement with something, it not even oftentimes, I think all the time, it shows a great deal of disrespect for the intellectual engagement on these issues and around the various people who were involved in these issues, so that the only thing that we can ever think is, you know, race, as if there are no other realities that we can engage or think about or, in, you know, involve the.
And they seize on that point. They seize on like that one.
Right.
Quote.
They seize on that point, and that becomes,
race
that
didn't
becomes
matter.
The point.
I would argue that it's just, there was a very dishonest narrative to characterize how race was being discussed. I think race mattered a lot. I think it matters a lot if all the ranks get, and I actually believe they're white supremacists. I know we can have that argument. They have a long history about this, but even if they're not, I think it matters whether nobody in higher ranks is black or Latino.
Oh, I think it matters.
It matters whether people leave the department in the lower ranks, and there are a lot of reasons for it. I think it matters if the person you picked police chief lasted only 6 months as New Hallville's district manager because there was not a respect with that community. I think those things matter, and we should be able to talk about them without racing to the simplified, skewed narrative that calls discussion about caring about race reverse racism, which really what it became.
Yes, and the other part of that, of course, is that the attempt to sort of scare us away from talking about race when race was used to demonize and debilitate and oppress us and that kind of stuff, it's fine. But when we start talking about race in a way that is useful and helpful to us,
then you're playing the race card.
Then we're playing the race card.
Playing the race card means a black person talking about race.
Right.
I mean, I'm concerned about, I mean, I think in all of this, I'm concerned about the gains that we've made over the last 30 years.
Oh, the white, the police department's been all wiped out.
And now we're back to square one. Now we have to sort of fight this fight all over again.
So what did you folks think about the announcement? I rambled on and on. What did you think when you found out who the new police chief is going to be?
I'm not surprised. I mean, I'm not.
Because, the mayor was against this person, passed over him twice.
This is a bad.
Got mad, saying, he didn't even interview him for acting chief, even though he was next in line. He kept hearing from the community that they wanted this chief. And by the way, I'm not weighing in on how you should pick a police chief and who. I'm just telling you the facts. Mm-hmm. And the chief, he was very mad. He even broke the charter and got taken to court, losing a ridiculous case to try to keep a person, his acting chief, who got rejected. And he keeps keeping that narrative in. He's not even acknowledging that there were any issues raised legitimate. He just says there was one minister, even though all these alders voted against. There was one minister who made a fuss because of his own agenda, and this was terrible, and she did a great job. I don't know. Maybe I should let that go for now. I kind of feel like that has implications moving forward. I don't know. Or is it a case that the mayor learned? No, like the mayor failed on this so many times. He picked the wrong person, stuck in the wrong person after got rejected, broke the law to try to keep the person in, got humiliated, and then picked someone he had been against that the community wanted, whether it's right or wrong.
Capitulation is not the same thing as learning. He just couldn't do anything else. I don't know this particular officer, so I can't really speak on that. But it doesn't really mean he learned. It just means he means he's.
Well,
like,
how do you feel? So you don't have an opinion on the pick because you don't know the guy, right?
I don't know.
What about you?
I mean, I mean, in the back of my mind, it's always for me the white man's ice is always colder. Like I always have that in the back of my mind when these kinds of things come up. Mm-hmm. As if there is no talented black people that could have come up the ranks. There's no consideration of anybody of color. There's no Latinos that they could have picked. There's no other.
So they would have either gone outside of the department or retired because we have some ridiculous rules that I think were written a couple of days ago to keep certain people out who someone had a vendetta against. You have to have supervised other supervisors for 5 years in a city, in a police department in a city that has at least 100,000 residents. So there was actually one black, not candidate, who was asked to apply who had a really strong record. But the police department he had overseen well used to be in a city that had been right under 100,000 population for those years. Isn't that crazy?
I mean, I think those things are designed for a lot of reasons to do just that, to keep somebody of that caliber out.
I think it was actually in the department. There was someone there who said, a college degree who actually was not a good cop. They wanted to keep out, put it head on the
street. But that's my point. Yeah. It's designed to keep somebody out.
Yeah.
It's designed to keep somebody out and not even.
I think the big question could be assistant chiefs. I think it's how you bring people up the ranks. So one thing that didn't get discussed was that when the person came in as acting chief, whom the mayor wanted, there was a very promising African-American detective who was in charge of major crimes and detectives, and she demoted him. And your eyebrows went up. We wrote it 5 times in the Independent. Nobody noticed. We put the charts 5 times in the Independent, 1 year after Black Lives Matter, how all the top ranks disappeared. Nobody cared anymore. Black lives did not matter to New Haven a year after Black Lives Matter. None of this even got registered as being an issue. But this is someone who you might see become assistant chief. There's an Indian American woman who might become assistant chief. I'm looking at who the assistant chiefs are because that's how you're getting people ready.
Yeah.
To get more responsible, and who are the people going to oversee the bureaus?
What was the basis of the demotion?
An argument was made that the person who has that position should be a captain because that's always been the case. I have not been able to find the last time a captain has had that position. It's been at least not this century. I don't think I really believe the person in charge had very negative views about Black people. She took a very hard line on disciplining Black officers who made mistakes. In each case, they done something wrong. But in one of those cases, that person acted after calling for advice to a white person who had more experience and was very close to the chief, who in fact organized white cops to come out for the chief, who in fact had many violence complaints against him. And that happened over and over again.
We dealt with that case. The civilian review board dealt with that case, yes. I had to recuse myself from it.
I mean, the disparity, and again, I'm not saying you shouldn't take a tough line because someone's Black did something wrong, but the fact that everybody was Black they went after strong, and in some cases you had high-ranking white people who were close to chief who didn't get touched.
Right.
That to me was just, and I felt this stuff was happening in plain sight in the last year, and nobody talked about it.
Yeah, there was no indication that, because the person that was disciplined and the person from whom they say they got the advice had two different stories.
They didn't investigate the white guy's story.
Him over her, but they did.
And they didn't investigate it. Like, I'm reading another IA involving a Black officer now, where it looks kind of bad. They went into such depth to check every fact of her story about what she did or didn't say on a phone call about a traffic stop. And I couldn't believe I read 100 pages. I had to do it in two sittings. Mm-hmm. This was something much more important. A guy broke through a window of his ex's house, threatened her, and then killed himself, right?
After
cops let him off drunk driving hours earlier. And in that case, the cop who had the in, who was had more years on the job and was close to the chief, said, well, there's no recording. Here's what I said, okay, we believe you and not the other person, not even looking at.
And like I said, there was no reason even given to say, this is why we believe this person over this person. It was a he say, she said situation. And
so people believe based on their comfort level.
So do you have either have advice for this new chief nominee or advice for the alders in deciding whether to approve him?
I don't know him. So
no, just in general about the police department. You've been studying police issues. What needs to happen with policing in New Haven? What kind of leadership do we need? What kind of direction? What kind of policies? He advocates something called legitimate policing. He says community policing. That word has become watered down. So it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. He says, legitimate policing, I'm sure you're familiar with, was this idea that's emerged in recent years where every interaction, no matter how small, that a police officer has with the public is going to determine whether the public trusts the police and how they see the police. And they will then act based on whether they think power is being used legitimately or not. So it's kind of an interesting point. So he's saying every time we interact with the public, they're going to form a conclusion of whether we're legitimately doing our jobs, and that's based on how they will act.
Who's forming the conclusion? The police?
No, the public. Like, in other words, like if a cop stops you and is rude, you're going to say, well, they don't follow rules. If they like jam you up and make up something, you're going to say, well, I'm not going to say what they tell to do, or I'm not going to cooperate because they're going to jam me up. But if you see them acting polite, listening to you and doing the right thing, then you might be more likely to trust them to tell them information or not cause a problem, not that could escalate when they stop you.
Well, we had one case,
civilian review.
On the civilian review that stands out in my head, where two young African-American boys really were arrested. They were sitting in their house. Yeah, they were in their house. Well, they weren't sitting in the house and they were arrested. They were sitting in the house and the police officers ran into the house and then they ran. They were at the police were at the wrong place because they were told, you know, somebody called and said, my house is broken into and the door was left open. They came on that street. They saw a door open and they went in.
Oh, no. I didn't hear about this kid.
And the house number was on the house. So they were at the wrong house. They didn't even check the house number. Kids ran out. They arrested them on interfering with police. Apparently, that's a charge if you run away from them.
Interfering has to be taken off the books. I've been threatened with that a million times. Like you are now interfering, meaning we look so many cases that are bogus.
How do you break into a wrong house?
They didn't break in.
I'm sorry.
The door was open. They ran in. And they say we're interfering with the police. And then
that just means
they didn't know at that point they went to the wrong house. And the other charge was of trespassing, because when the kids ran, they ran on the other yards.
Oh,
the
my houses goodness. Next
to, right. And I was like, are you kidding me right now? Are you literally kidding me right now? But the thing that really stood out to me, one of the things that stood, because a lot of things stood out in that case, one of the police officers asked the kid when he got caught him, he goes, why did you run? it wasn't like that. He was screaming at me. Why did you run? Why did you run? And the kid goes, I'm a Black man in America and police officers are chasing me. Yeah. Which makes perfect sense to us, right?
Mm-hmm.
That police officer screamed at him and he goes, it's always that. It's always that. Just worry about yourself.
Oh.
The lack of empathy, the lack of historical information, the lack of knowledge about how African-Americans have had to deal with the police and that kind of stuff, or just a lack of concern about that was so evident in that statement.
When and where was that case?
I've done so many cases. It wasn't that long ago. It was.
And what happened? How did they deal with it?
How we dealt with it. Well, we wrote a scathing report. You know, first of all, they were let go. The mother came down to the police office and she was livid, as she should have been. She was livid. And there were people who were trying to focus attention on her. You know, she comes into the police office and she's screaming, she's yelling, she's cussing, whatever. And they're trying to put, and I said, you know, so what part of what she did was against the law exactly? Since you're trying to focus on her?
They always use interfering.
They said the boy's interfering, but when she came to the police office and was like, where's my son?
No, but they could still say interfering.
Yeah, but
she
wasn't a part of the rest of the complaint, whatever.
But even if she's at the police department, they could say that's interfering. They could say anything.
That's not what they were saying.
Yeah, because they could say you're doing that right
now. That's not what they were saying. That's what the police officer was saying. Mm-hmm. That's what some people on the civilian review board were saying.
Wow.
You know, look at her. You can tell where they got it from. And I'm like, oh my God. Are you kidding me?
Oh, you said with people white or black who said that?
So some of the people on the review board said that.
I know the people on the review board, were they white or black?
Some people on the review board said that.
I don't know if it matters if it's well.
Okay, I'm sorry.
They're white.
So but how anyway, was it disposed of?
Well, with the police, they ultimately just let them go. But we wrote a scathing report on everything. You know, the police officers. You know, went to the wrong house. They chased his kids. They arrested them. They screamed at them. They yelled at them. They did all these kind of things. They put them in lockup. But I had to say, you know, teach the review board people, you know, this is a black woman whose child has been arrested
for being in their home,
for being inside their house.
Yeah.
And you are focusing on how she's reacting. Are you kidding me right now?
But your job is to look at whether officers should be.
Yes. But
so
no,
what did you guys decide?
No. But the job also, as far as I'm concerned, is for us as a board to be objective about what we're dealing with.
I'm agreeing with you.
And
about
so
the
when people were not doing that, I think it was incumbent upon.
Oh, yeah. I'm not questioning what you said to your colleagues. I'm saying the matter before you was how the police acted. Right.
Right. So what the review board does, and a lot of people don't understand this, we don't punish police officers. That's not what that board is set up to do. Our job was to write reports and write reviews on what we saw and send that to the chief.
So
where the
chief
police
say?
Department, they don't respond to us. They just get the stuff and
did they act?
They move forward
with it.
I don't know what they did. I don't remember actually.
Okay,
I think they may have done something, but I don't know what they did. But it was, it was, you know, it was a lot going on in that case.
Wow, we got to learn
from
more
both
that.
The board and the police department.
Wow, and we're talking about that on Pundit
Thursday. So the reason I said this is because you say, you know, what should they do? And I sat down and had a conversation with the lieutenant who was, you know, helping us and giving us the files and that kind of stuff. And I was like, you know, there's a complete lack of empathy here. You know, that's something that needs to be taught. Police officers need to understand how different communities in the community have had to deal with police, what their suspicions are of police. They need to understand that. The way he responded to this kid's, you know, answer to why you ran was one thing. He shouldn't even have to ask that question. He should have known why he ran.
It's kind of obvious.
Yeah.
Mm. All right. Well, we're talking about that on Dateline New Haven Thursday Pundits with Reverend Samuel Lee and Babs Rawls Ivy. Ready for a quote, folks?
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Not quite as heavy, but it matters. Quote, our staff members have been working hard right through the pandemic. Okay. They support the system and allow the system to continue to float and not sink.
Mm.
Give you a hint. It's an explanation why a certain check is being cut. Some people are getting a bonus in town.
Oh, this is about the the teachers.
Yep, that was superintendent of schools. Yeah, Eileen Tracy. So they voted this week that every full-time teacher in New Haven is getting a $1,000 bonus, every part-timer, and also paraprofessional.
Is that taxed?
Oh, that's a good question. Probably. And $500 for part-time.
$200.
Saying you didn't leave. Some of you are leaving. It's been tough. People bouncing off the walls, trying to deal with the pandemic, how to be back in school. There's been all this misbehavior. There's been learning deficits, stress in your own lives, health scares. What do you think about that? Right move, given these bonuses?
Probably.
And it's federal anti-pandemic money, relief money. So
Probably. And teachers don't get paid enough. Anyway, the profession doesn't get paid enough. I always try to make that distinction. I don't necessarily think that every teacher should be made, be automatically paid a certain amount of money, but I think the profession should be paid at least $100,000 coming in, quite frankly.
Wow.
But I think that should,
I've never made money like that.
That should come with certain requirements.
Such as
an earned master's degree in education and a bachelor's degree in a subject, not in education. I think that's a, to me, that doesn't really seem like a real,
like, know what you're teaching about rather than just how to teach.
Right.
So you have starting pay at 100.
Yes.
Well, you were in line with another quote from the head of teachers union, Glass Toe, said this is a nice start, but many neighboring districts are making competitive offers to teachers that we can't refuse. I mean, the teachers aren't quitting, but are leaving. It's because the suburbs are paying so much more money. Although I live next door in New Haven, and someone teaches in the suburbs says the kids are really bouncing off the walls there too. And but they are paying them more, and the teachers who don't want to quit are getting lured by more money. So to your point, Babs, thoughts?
I mean, you know, I sit on the board of Common Ground, and you know, we struggle often with bringing salaries up that our neighboring school boards are able to provide. I think the teaching profession, as Reverend Ross Lee said, is should have a higher entrance salary. That's hard work, because we ask teachers to do a lot of things before teaching even happens. Mm-hmm. We ask them to be the eyes and ears of what is happening with that child. We ask them to determine whether or not there's mental health issues. We ask them to pay attention if they're hungry. We ask them to pay attention to other signs before we even start teaching anything. They have to go above and beyond what they are asked to do.
I got two quotes for you now, and from people who don't agree. Quote, I know this is harming our children. That's one quote. The other person said, the diverse population of students are not always represented in the research studies that tout success of one program or another. We know there's no silver bullet. What are they talking about?
Reading?
Yes. Bingo, boo, boo, boo. Last night, Wednesday night, there was a hearing at the Board of Alders. Mm. And it came at a really interesting time. It's about, are we going to change the way we're teaching kids to read? Because the kids are more than half the kids in elementary grades are below, more than half are below proficiency. And it's a big deal because it's hard to catch up when you don't start early. Nationally, there's been a sea change. There's a big front page story in the New York Times about on Sunday about how to teach kids to read. And I'd been out of this for 25 years, this debate. I thought it was settled 25 years ago that kids all learn different ways. And some kids spell out with phonics. Someone goes whole words, look at a whole word and look at a picture, try to guess. So balanced literacy is this idea that you teach all these different ways to different kids, and you don't, phonics might be one part of it, but not a big deal part of it. The woman who pioneered that and designed the curriculum for the whole country, 67,000 school districts, has renounced it because it's been like 10, 15 years of brain science that says it's not a natural thing to learn how to read. How your brain is figuring out how to read, if they're teaching you to guess based on a picture or feelings about stories or how you context, you're not going to be able to learn other words. Mm-hmm. And that they actually looked at how the neurons light up. I don't know how they do this. And that you had to sound out stuff like we used to. Mm-hmm. That yes, you do other things too. Yes, if there are kids who are getting English second language, especially if it's 10 to 15% of special ed, but the other kids, you know, culturally different, you might want to look at other things too, how they're feeling about reading, but there's no substitute for teaching them phonics, spelling, and diction. So the Connecticut State Legislature passed a law, Right to Read, and they're requiring every state, within a year, every school district has to move to what they call structural literacy, phonics, spelling, diction being a big part of it. They did a test of it at Barnard School. It's the scores are way up. But New Haven might be an outlier. New Haven is not into it. They're saying that we kind of believe what we were saying before, that every kid's different. We got to look at it. We're not sure the teachers can be trained in a new way. And there's a question of whether they might seek a waiver to do some other curriculum or how long they want to take to do it. This came to head to head. There are these teachers who are trying to push it at a hearing last night at the Board of Alders Education Committee. And there's teachers saying, look, the science has changed. This is how we want to do it. Let's do what the rest of the state do is let's move on it. And the school district was pushing back saying, let's not just go for the new fad. Kids are different. You're not being culturally responsive. Black kids, Latino kids might look different. Poor kids might learn different. And we want to have this whole process. We're going to start over looking at what the brain science is and looking at whether the teachers might have too much on their plate in the next year to have to learn this through professional development. Are they really going to have time to learn a different way? And they just ordered a whole new set of elementary school books and libraries based on the old approach.
What is the basis of calling it a fad?
I understand what they're saying. It's because this was what they're teaching now 30 years ago. It was kind of like, this is the big current theory. And people who were like at this hearing were showing up at hearings and saying, we got to move to this balanced literacy. We got to let every kid succeed based on being different. And it became sort of the current way everyone thinks. Like in my life, there are many times I've said, look, everyone's saying this is the way to do it. Let's go do it, right? New Haven did that with urban renewal. A lot of idealistic people thought urban renewal, which became Negro removal, right? You know that term? A lot of people of color, too, thought this was great. It was like the greatest fresh idea that smart people are talking about based on their studies. And it turned out to be way wrong. So I think the school district's saying maybe that's one of these things. Let's not just switch fads so quick.
Yeah, but if the new information is based on scientific research.
And it's like study after study after study for the whole.
So what is the basis of calling it a fad?
Yeah, I guess.
Just because it's new does not mean it's a fad.
I think it's because decision makers used to do a certain way. There's certain way. I'm a little older than you folks, I think. Sort of my generation, we kind of feel like this is what we learned is the way it's done. It's not so easy to learn it some new way.
I don't understand any of this.
Well, there's an interesting racial element to it. So the state legislator who pushed it is black, a woman from Fairfield County. Gary Winfield is black, was introducing it last night. But most of the teachers in New Haven who are pushing it are white. The woman who spoke last night, Amber Moy, is black. But because she was teaching the new way in Barnard. Whereas the school administrators and board members who are resistant, who have been there a long time, are of color, and they're saying you don't understand kids of color.
That actually means little, very little to me. If you look at the research, if you're looking at the situation, you're saying, has this gone through some scientific process? Has this been peer reviewed? Do we have factual information about this? It shouldn't matter who pushes it, whether it's Gary Winfield or Donald Trump. It should not matter. Where does the information come from? From where does the information come? And what is the legitimacy of it? That is what should matter. We get so caught up in who said who and what said what, as opposed to looking at the substantive aspect of the situation.
And it was so interesting to see that story in the Times Sunday of the woman who made her whole career on this. She got renowned scholar around the world where 67,000 school districts were using her curriculum. She is. And she said, I was wrong. She said, I screwed up. I've been reading these studies now for years and years. And the brain just doesn't work that way. And the kids aren't going to learn to read.
But with her, I'm sorry, with her, when she came up with what she came up with, was that peer reviewed? Was that gone through some scientific process?
I think it was.
Okay. And so now we're saying because we have more information or different information, whatever, that's how science works.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, I think that's how science works when it's not manipulated against one or another. Yeah. You know, you can make the case scientifically just about anything. I'm a science person. I went to college for science. I get it. But I also know that sometimes the experimentation, the try things, let's try these things and see. The kids that are harmed mostly are the black and brown kids.
Oh, there is no question. 35% achievement gap in reading in the state. Yeah. 35%.
Yeah, listen, I ran an early childhood program called, you know, Jumpstart for Young Children.
Oh, yeah, I didn't know that. But I can't keep up with all things you've done. Or like, when did you do that?
Which sent me to the White House talking to President Clinton about early childhood education and got me the Points of Light Award.
Whoa.
Yes. I know something about early childhood education and Jumpstart for Young Children was all about school readiness and getting children ready to read. Uh-huh. And, you know, honestly, The best way to teach children how to read is to read to them and with them.
Yeah, we all know that.
Consistently.
Teaching the kids early, yeah.
Listen, I always tell people, I come from people who learn how to read and write at the light of the moon. So it's not magic
well,
here.
Well, you were doing pre-K.
Pre-K.
Yeah, and that's
because
where
that's all, because but
and that's essential. You're teaching the love reading.
3 to 5 year olds, that's when your brain is the most ready to learn.
Yeah, and I think what we're having here is now in kindergarten, elementary school, do you start with the phonics?
Well, I think if we talked about universal pre-K, okay.
You can start the letters.
Then you can start, and I think it would go a long way.
And everyone agrees it's not either or. Nobody disagrees.
No, I don't think it's either or.
You teach
either.
That love of learning.
I think it's an and. I think, you know, as early as you can get children school ready, and not in a hard way, but in ways that make sense for children to learn, that makes it fun and enjoyable, then we should be doing those things.
Mm-hmm.
Some kids start school later. Some kids start school earlier. Some kids come to school with a huge vocabulary already. Some kids never get a huge vocabulary until they get to like third grade. Do you know what I'm saying? So their kids are very different in their approach to learning and reading. I like the idea of that we take that into consideration.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not for an all or nothing kind of attempt at teaching reading.
Yeah. All right. We're talking about it on Dateline New Haven's Thursday Pundits, Babs Rolls Ivy, the Reverend Sam Ross Lee. Here's a quote, folks. Ready? I can't tell you how many people have called me, have shown up to my house.
Oh.
And I just see walking around the neighborhood who told me, who looked me in the eyes and said, vote no. I over-dramatized that.
Yes, you did. What are we voting no for?
I don't know unless you tell us what it is.
Alder Avshalom Smith.
Oh, my alder.
Devin Avshalom Smith.
Who was one of only two alders who voted this week against our new $660 million general fund budget for the new fiscal year in New Haven. It had been changed by the Board of Alders. And I think he and everyone would agree the Board of Alders did a great job in fixing partly a problem the mayor caused and what a committee caused. We can talk about that and not talk about it. But he voted no because taxes are still going up somewhat. We got $49 million we didn't used to get in pilot state reimbursement that we always said we needed so we didn't have to raise taxes. We got $10 million extra a year from Yale. We said we need more money from Yale. We got $200 million for the school board in the city in pandemic relief money. And we reevaluated property, which means if your property went up, the mill rate comes down, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't lower the mill rate enough to have it not be a tax increase. So the board voters did cut stuff. So the tax increase really isn't that big, except for a few people like some of Devin's constituents who own a house that went way up in value. So now the tax bill goes up. So what we did, the alders said, sorry, we can't hire more LCI inspectors or fire captains, library techs. Yes, we can hire a few like civil engineer, tech officer, and we can give the board of education a $4.5 million increase, not a $5 million increase. What did you guys think about what Devin said? Or what did you think about the budget?
You know, he is a policy guy. So you know, he works at policy at the state level too. You know,
yeah. So I think what wasn't discussed enough was it was sort of like the thing happened with the police department. When our taxes got reevaluated, which shouldn't happen every 10 years, it's 5 and 10, but the big stuff is 10. Because what that happens is throws everything out of whack. So if your house goes up a lot in value, your house is worth more and you can sell for more. But in the meantime, if you want to stay there and you're old and you don't have a lot of money, you're going to pay a lot more taxes quick. But the problem is somebody else's house value went down is subsidizing you if we don't make you pay that right away. So the mayor sat with these homeowners in Fairhaven, working class people, and they said, my house price went up 80%. I'm going to pay like another $2,000 or $1,000. I don't have it. He goes, I'm making you a promise. We're going to wait 5 years to phase in the increase for the whole city. So it'll take 5 years till your taxes go up like that. The problem was when you looked at the numbers, which Tom Breen did, you're going to be helping some of those people, but you're really screwing a lot more working class people. And I'll tell you why. If you wait 5 years to phase it in, that means people who built these luxury apartment buildings or the slumlords who have been flipping these properties, making all this money with outside investment without approving it, they've been getting a break because their property values went up, but the new assessment didn't come. The city didn't say it's worth more money yet. So when they do, they finally are supposed to pay the amount of money based on its worth. But if he's helping those Fairhaven owners, he's also helping Mandy Management and the builder of the Corsair in 360 State. We've already told those big guys you get 5 years to phase in. How much you have to pay taxes is a reason for that. But now it's another 5 years. So Corsair, Tom Breen found out, $500,000 less than they'd have to pay in taxes if you phase it in.
Wow.
So we have to pay that. And meanwhile, some other working class homeowner has to pay it either for the Fairhaven person. So we thought there was an easy solution. Just look at that smaller group you wanted to help, like Devin's constituents. You got this federal relief money. Help them phase in the cost of their increase. But don't do a phase in for the whole city and subsidize luxury developers and slumlords. And don't make other people who work in class whose values didn't go way up have to pay for it. So the Board of Alders cut the baby in half. They said, let's make a 2-year phase in instead of a 5 to cushion the shock, but not have it be so expensive for everybody else.
So Devin worked on the board, the Civilian Review Board. Smart guy. Philosophy major. I think he's doing a PhD in philosophy, actually. I was a philosophy major in college.
I'm sorry, where'd you go?
At Morehouse College, the best college in the world. In Atlanta, Georgia.
That was before Harvard. Yeah, man. I'm sorry. I throw it out there.
Morehouse College. So I don't know much about this issue, much about the situation. I haven't really studied it. But I trust Devin's intellect on this. And I do trust also that he is concerned about his constituents in a significant way. So I'm going to go with
that. Okay, I'll give you a different call. I think you went over this. This district is overdue for representation and a stronger voice for the community that actually comes from the community. Mm.
That's not the police department. No,
no, no. They would never say that there.
It sounds like Washington, D.C., but go ahead.
Daryl Brackeen Jr., who's an alder. He's running for state rep. He's challenging Pat Dillon for the 92nd General Assembly seat in Westville, West River, Dwight.
Wasn't he running for something else?
He was Secretary of State.
Yeah, Secretary
of State. And before that, it was something else?
Yeah. So he's running. He says, look, 43% of our district is black. 31% is white. She's white, I'm black.
Really?
She's been in there a long time. She's been there 38 years.
That's a better argument.
Is she good at what she does?
That's a better argument.
So that other argument is interesting. I agree with you. So that's the Rosa DeLauro case. The Republicans are going to say, you've been there since 1990, 32 years. That's long enough. You lose touch. You need term limits. She says, I learned how it works. I bring home the bacon. I brought home a lot of bacon now. I got this power of vision in the House Appropriations Chair so I can make a bigger difference. It's a little bit similar with that. Pat Dillon, she said, like when we wanted to have a gun violence new body commission in the state, I kind of knew about the way statistics were kept at, at emergency rooms. I knew who to ask to try to get it over. And I was able to make that thing happen. I was able to get the state money when I saw it was available, come from the feds to the state for first road speeding. Brackeen says there's still a lot of people with problems you haven't addressed over those years. New blood brings it home. Mm. Any thoughts or any predictions about the race?
As someone who has been elected twice, we never use this analogy of term limits in any other area other than this. You know how long it takes to get the lay of the land in any elected arena? It takes a long time. And at that level where Pat Dillon is, it takes a long time to get any measurable things done for this state.
So
for Rosa DeLauro, the same thing. We don't say that to dentists or doctors or lawyers or anybody else. We don't say it to ministers. We don't say you could only be a minister.
I think I heard a little shade there.
You could only be a minister for 20 years and therefore you need to be pushed out. We don't say that. But somehow or other, for elected officials who have dedicated their lives to this work, if she was shady or if she was, not delivering or whatever, then, the people can vote her out. But I don't know if the people will want to vote her out.
So you're saying we have term limits that are called elections. What do you think, Reverend Wesley?
I think term limits is a better argument than I'm black and she's white.
I agree with you there.
But I'm not saying that based on because I don't have a dog in the fight against either one of them or for either one of them. But I don't think that's his best argument. I think term limits is his best argument. I don't think political representation in political office is the same thing as being a professional dentist or a sanitation worker or a editor of a newspaper.
We should have term limits. Actually, I think we should have term limits.
I don't think those are the same thing.
Well, do you agree with this quote? And I know you're going to know who this is. This is nothing more than manipulating by Judas Goats for political gain.
Is that three-fifths?
How'd you know?
I was thinking it, but I didn't want to
He's
say
talking
it.
About we got new maps. We redistricted New Haven. It was controversial all over the country, New York, Florida. We just redistricted our older districts, and there were some complaints, but in general went through. And we got new maps. We have to do it every 10 years. Mm. And there was an issue there.
You have to do it every 10 years, or you have to consider it every 10 years?
You have to do it every 10 years because the census, you have to have a certain number of people per ward. Okay. So we grew by 4,000 of 4,200 residents. Mm. So every district has to be within a certain, we have 30 wards within 1/30th of the population within a few percentage points. So every district had to be 4,200 to 4,600 people. So they redrew the lines, and there are three parts of town where neighborhoods that could be contiguous are chopped up. Ward 25 in Westville, right? They took two streets. It's kind of like, you know, the flats as opposed to Upper Westville. So it kind of goes from Fountain Street to Chapel and it kind of, or Route 34, and it kind of goes from Forest Road to Edgewood Park. But they chopped off two parts near the Yale Fields and jumped over the park to parts of West River.
Okay.
And there actually was nothing venal there. It was just darn complicated because a population moved east. And it was just hard to keep everything intact. But in Fairhaven, Ward 14 is like a peninsula. So that's sort of like the part with inside all the rivers, but a little chunks in the annex, a little parts in the heights. So Sarah Miller said, it should be one contiguous neighborhood. And the two other alders in Fairhaven said, I don't want to give up parts of my district because I know someone there or someone lives there who supports me. And that's really what happens in redistricting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think that districts, because this happened nationally, when they talk about younger districts, so it's the majority black population to elect a black office holder. Do you think districts, whether it's a neighborhood in a city or a congressional district, and I'm leaving aside the obvious bad thing where they draw these crazy shapes so that you can have a white majority so that in a place like Tennessee, they divide Nashville into three so that rural white areas can have all the representation and nobody liberal or black can get elected. We know that's wrong. But how should we think of districts? Some people think it's good to have diverse districts where different interests have a say, rather than just one place you lump everybody. Like in Alabama, I think it is. There was an agreement among black incumbent lawmakers with Republican white lawmakers to concentrate lots of black votes where black representatives were so they can get reelected. But so you draw the maps that black voters have no say in any of the other districts, rather than districts where black voters might be 35%, and to get elected, you have to not ignore them. Hmm. Any thoughts?
I think diverse districts is a good thing. I think politicians need to have to deal with constituents that are, you know, not this homogeneous, you know, group of people. I'm not convinced that, black politicians can't be elected, you know.
Oh, they can.
You know, yeah, in districts where
truly
where they're white people and it's diverse. So I think it should be diverse.
Yeah. And then what about neighborhoods? Because that's not quite the same issue of race. So like Ward 21, you know, that's a weird one. That goes down to parts of Dixville, part of New Hovel, part of Prospect Hill Mansions. And again, that's diverse. That's kind of cool. But you kind of have streets where people live across the street from each other and they're not in the same district advocating the same way. Do you think there should be an effort to have like parts of New Hovel, parts of Westville, parts of Fairhaven kind of be a coherent whole rather than have these little appendages of other neighborhoods that are kind of afterthoughts?
I mean, I think neighborhoods are going to change. I mean, they're just going to have to change as people age and move out of communities, as downtown becomes more developed and downtown is going to start looking like older people. When older people give up their big houses in Westville and they want to live downtown.
Or Woodbridge.
You know, when they give up those things, they're going to move downtown. Why do they move downtown? Because they like the diversity and all the things that come with that, right? And so people raise their families in neighborhood, but when they age out, they want to have a life downtown.
Well, now Ward 6, which is the hill, now has big chunks of those new buildings.
And that's going to look very different.
Yeah.
And what they feel about the hill is going to be very different than people who are from the hill proper.
So next time we could talk about how all those new residents vote only in even number of years because they don't really care who's running New Haven. They only care about who's the president. I want to thank you folks for joining us today on Dateline New Haven Thursday Pundits. Bowser Rolls Ivy and the Reverend Samuel Ross Lee.
It is.
Thank you for making time for us.
He's not going to come back, though, but it was good.
Maybe if we bring Harry Gross, come in, will you come in?
Absolutely not.
Oh, okay. we know the parameters. I want to thank Harry Gross for running the board.
My friend Harry alone. Harry is smart.
No, but I really do. I feel it's an honor to chat with both of you, and I really appreciate your insights.
Thank you.
We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Feel to Be Free from the group CD, A Plea for Peace. This is Paul Bass inviting you to fly free with us all day, all night,
Harrison,
at WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio. Thank you.